The following message by Alistair Begg is made available by Truth For Life. For more information, visit us online at truthforlife.org.
What I want to do is to begin by reading words from probably Solomon, one of the wise men of an earlier era. And I'm going to read these from the end of a book about meaning and about life and about life and death issues. It's called Ecclesiastes. It's a word that means the teacher or the professor or the preacher. And at the end of his treatment, he writes as follows. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. This is a word picture here. You would recognize of a human body. The keepers of the house being the hands, the strong men being the legs. And when the grinders cease, you've got the picture now, those of you who are from the dental community. This is a picture of inadequate occlusion. When the grinders cease because they are few, and those looking through the windows grow dim, those of you who are from the ophthalmology department. When the doors to the street are closed, those of you from the hearing community, and the sound of grinding fades. When men rise up at the sound of birds, those of you from the geriatric department, but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire no longer is stirred. I'll leave that department entirely on its own. The man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring, or the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. They are collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. All right, we'll return to that before we all fall asleep just before 9:30. In his book, Rethinking Life and Death, one of the more notorious professors of our day, Professor Peter Singer, the Australian, argues that the traditional Western ethic has collapsed. The traditional Western ethic has collapsed. And I think that any significant scanning of the evidence would lead one to the conclusion that his assessment is actually accurate. That the ethic upon which so much decision-making has been based has actually collapsed. Some of us who are here tonight can recall a period of time when the question, what will your grandmother say, actually proved to be the gold standard when it came to the issue of childhood ethical arbitration. There really needed to be nothing more said. Grandmother had a perspective on things, and what she thought about it was going to be of significance. But that was a time, unlike today, when answers lay to hand, when the principles involved were axiomatic, when the practices, permitted or forbidden, were black and white in their clarity. But that day, those days, known to many and unknown to the rest of us, have faded into obscurity. They have gone. In fact, if you listen to the average grandmother now talking to her grandchildren in the course of a journey on a plane or in the mall, it is more likely to be the very reverse of the situation when the grandmother is deeply concerned about what her little grandson may have to say concerning her performance as a grandmother. And we are awaking every day to a world in which scientific advance, as we've already seen this evening, scientific advance outruns our ability or our willingness to provide suitable ethical responses. I go routinely to the Times. That is not the New York Times, although I do read the New York Times on a daily basis, but to the Real Times, which is the Times of London. And in the Times of London this Tuesday, October the 18th, there was an interesting piece on older women being denied a baby by ever increasingly strict IVF laws. And the piece was essentially saying, if we want to be able to do this and compete with America, then we're going to have to lighten up in our approach. And part of it reads as follows: strict rules that ban British fertility doctors from implanting most women with more than two embryos are costing hundreds of couples the chance of starting a family, one of America's most senior IVF specialists said yesterday. That was Monday. The arbitrary system means that many couples who suffer from severe fertility problems are failing to get the radical therapy that is their best hope of a baby and is causing British clinics to fall well behind their competitors in the US, he said. It's interesting, isn't it, when you start to think about healthcare in terms of competition, in terms of the whole business ethic which drives decisions that are being made that are underpinned by moral and ethical factors. He goes on to argue and observe that the decision about how many embryos to implant should be left, it says, to the clinical judgment of doctors. Why? And he said, I don't think arbitrary government limits are the best approach. But neither is unbridled individual freedom for patients and physicians good medical care. So in the absence of unbridled individual freedom, or in the absence of government interference, we're going to allow the decision on these issues to lie with you good folks. About which I'm fairly happy, depending on what you good folks do with the larger questions that relate to life and death issues, to the bigger questions of moral philosophy. In that larger sphere, you have the privilege and responsibility of making these significant decisions regarding these finite issues. Now, when you look at that, and I just pulled that arbitrarily, but when you look at that and consider the average newspaper in the morning, it's not strange to suggest that we wake up and we find ourselves in a sea of interminable and apparently unresolvable debates. Debates about abortion, euthanasia, cloning, as we've seen this evening, stem cell research, and all of them matters of life and death. And this is made all the more alarming if we entertain the notion that the vessel in which we sail on this sea, if that vessel has no captain, no navigational system, and no declared destination. From that perspective, in the matter of morality, we are steaming steadily nowhere. Now, all of that by way of introduction. My brief this evening is to stay as far away from the medical and scientific specifics as I possibly can. No one told me to do that. I'm just so smart that I know to do that. These questions are being addressed and will be addressed in this room. But beyond that, those express questions, which will be the consideration of tomorrow as well, these crucial questions of life and death are addressed by individuals like yourselves in accord with each individual's overarching view of the world, so that decisions about specific issues are made within the larger framework of a person's worldview. There will inevitably then be a significant difference between the approach of atheistic humanism and Christian theism. In the latter case, the moral mandate about which we're asked to think this evening, the moral mandate is imposed divinely. That's the claim. In the former case, atheistic humanism, then any moral mandate, any ethical framework, has to be imposed either by the self or by the society, but denies any place to a lawgiver. Now, just so we're very clear about things, let me define our terms for a moment. First of all, the word ethics is derived from a Greek word, which you all know, which is ethos. It simply means custom or usage. It sometimes is referred to as custom or practice as determined by law. So to act morally or ethically was and is to act in accord with the inherited customs and laws of a people. So, for example, Judaism. And what makes a choice a moral choice is that it is judged against a binding standard or principle. For example, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. So, for example, choosing to drive a red car or a blue car, all other things being equal, is not a moral choice. But choosing to drive either color of car at 90 miles an hour in a 35 mile per hour speed zone is actually a moral choice. And the reason that it is a moral choice is because it is related to the commonly accepted and held standards of speed limits upon which society has at that point agreed. So ethics is concerned with manner of life, it's concerned with behavior, it's concerned with the questions of right and wrong. It operates on the basis of norms and standards, and those norms and standards then dictate how we ought to act, how we ought to live, how we ought to decide. Now, this happens all day, every day, in every sphere of life. The college professor hands out the exams, says, here is your examination paper. You ought not to cheat. A fellow has one of his school chums come over to take his sister out for an evening to the cinema. And he greets his buddy at the door. And he says, this is my sister. You ought to treat her with respect. The individual says, this is a human embryo and ought not to be tampered with. The 57-year-old man says, this is my father and you ought to sustain his fleeting life at all costs and by all means. All of these are directly related to the issue of oughtness. Now, we can spend the whole evening thinking about oughtness, but we won't. You can relax. But if you think about oughtness with me for just a moment, oughtness is the middle ground between law and freedom. Oughtness is the realm in a society or in a culture where shared givens make it possible for people to live cohesively, to live harmoniously. And when a sense of oughtness bleeds from a culture, then the only methodology for repair lies either in the realm of law, litigation, or in the realm of government interference, or even worse, in the realm of sort of anarchic activity, where people just bring people into, just coerce people by the power of might. Now, this may seem, you know, to be quite a dramatic thought, but here from 2002, the 25th of September 2002 is the New York Times. This is important, incidentally, if you're going to ever talk, to have a good filing system. This is a piece, I won't bore you with it, but it says, remember to play nicely. In this Long Island County, it's the law. And what this article is about is about the fact that in this particular community in Long Island, they were no longer able to conduct their little league games in baseball, basketball, and soccer with any sense of propriety because of the activities on the part of the parents, mainly the fathers, who were cursing and swearing and fighting with each other and doing all manner of bad things. And the attempt to say to Mr. Jenkins, you know, you ought not to do that, was met by the response, you ought to go and take a flying leap, which was then met by whatever it was. And in the loss of oughtness, they had to litigate. It's hardly surprising, is it, that in a nation that is full of litigators, we are the most litigated country in the whole of the Western world. And a lot of what relates to the issues that you folks face is directly tied to a loss of oughtness that was present at a previous period in the country, which is directly related to the observation of Singer concerning the collapse of the Western ethic. Now, you're sensible people. You can think this out, can't you? In the late 18th century, David Hume, whom we all had to think about at school for a while, David Hume, a Scotsman, questioned the legitimacy of deducing what one ought to do from what is the case. And in that whole realm of moral philosophy, another Scotsman, Adam Smith, who was a bit of an economist as well, you may recall, he was involved right up to the hilt in the intellectual effort to justify by philosophical analysis alone, without any deference to divine revelation, he attempted to make sure that by means of rationale, the major tenets of the foundational Judeo-Christian ethical code could be maintained. And of course, what we're talking about there is the period of the Enlightenment. Up until the period of the Enlightenment, the oughtness came from God. People agreed with one another. God said you shouldn't do this, therefore I guess we shouldn't. The Enlightenment comes along and says, you know, we really don't need to deal with a God saying you should or you shouldn't. After all, rationality can replace revelation. And we are capable of introducing our own norms and our own codes, and we don't need any laws from any kind of creator. The fascinating thing is now in the 21st century, although it goes back before this century, the Enlightenment has been swallowed up by what it has created. That Enlightenment thinking has paved the way for the postmodern approach to life, which denies that there is any objective basis for believing anything to be true or to be right. So that Enlightenment, having moved God from the position and replaced it with rationale, now finds at this point in history that it is passé as well, because everybody knows that there is no basis upon which we can make these distinctions. Now again, and this goes back a long way, this is 1987, this is the 10th of July, 1987. No, it's not, because this is written American style. So that means it's the 7th of September, Actually, that doesn't even make sense either, but it doesn't matter. This is a piece in the Wall Street entitled Ethics, Anyone, or Morals? Professor Crystal, the John M. Olin Professor of Social Thought at NYU Graduate School of Business. He wrote a very, very interesting article, and I'll just give you a brief quote from it. What he's saying is that in a previous time, ordinary people knew right from wrong, even if they went about reaching their conclusions in different ways. In the 20th century, all this has changed. Modern moral philosophy, what in academia is now called ethics, is no longer committed to moral instruction or moral elevation. It is proudly value-free, i.e., committed to radical, rationalist, and supposedly scientific skepticism. Many of the older arguments continue, but with no moral fervor and no moral implications. Ethicists, as they are now called, explore logical contradictions and logical loopholes and logical dilemmas in systems of moral propositions constructed by other ethicists. In other words, if you want to be an ethicist, what you do is you sit round and you don't argue about whether there are decisions of right and wrong to be made as much as you argue about whether the ethicist at, you know, NYU is a good soul or a bad soul, or is making any sense or not. In addition, they survey value systems of all communities, past and present, without being judgmental about them. It is taken for granted that none of this has anything to do with the practice of morality by actual human beings. Did you get the irony of this? The highest levels of academic moral thinking is directly tied to the fact that the product of it has got nothing to do at all with any kind of moral impact. I don't wish, says Professor Crystal, to suggest that though their assumptions add up to a kind of moral nihilism, our ethicists are themselves less moral, or of course more moral, than the rest of us. They lead perfectly conventional lives for the most part, even if they cannot explain why. Right? Here is your exam. You ought not to cheat. Of course, I can't tell you why you ought not to cheat. But you just ought not to cheat. Now, I can see that some of you are moving into the second stage of anesthesia. You're doing very well. and so I've got no way whatsoever of being able to bring you back from that predicament. But I will pay careful attention if anyone goes into the third stage. Now, when you go to the doctor, if you remember, some of you who ever go to the doctor, eventually the fellow or the lady says, get up on the table, or get up on the, sit up on the thing, or lie up on the thing, or whatever it is. A very inhumane experience. Prior to that, of course, you've been sitting for a significant part of your life, celebrating a couple of birthdays, having met with a nurse who took your blood pressure to try and justify our existence and asked how you were doing and stood on the scales that didn't look to be any better than the ones in my bathroom. And eventually, she says the doctor will be in with you in a moment, which is a euphemism for some time before you grow a beard, if you're a man. I have a sneaking suspicion that in that interim, the nurse hurries down a corridor to tell you, the doctor, about who's in there and what they're actually on about, so that you can look up your fat medical textbooks and find out what it is before you come down to try and give a diagnosis. Which is a horribly cynical perspective, and I know isn't true, but I thought I'd mention it just to annoy you. Because I know you're in those other rooms, because I hear you coming in and out the rooms. I don't know what you're doing, but anyways, it's prolific. I stand in awe of you. I hear you can move from, never mind, you can move from here to there and all points in between. And anyway, you finally get the patient up, and you examine with a view to diagnosis. So let me put the patient up here with a view to diagnosis, and we'll say a word finally about treatment. The patient, of course, is postmodern Western culture. It's a very large patient, I think you'll agree. It's going to take a large couch for this one, with a particular interest in the United States of America. In other words, we're going to put the culture in which we live up on the table, and we're going to poke around for a little bit. As soon as we put this culture up on the table, we realize that this is a culture in crisis. I mean, you don't have to be a genius as an observer to realize that this thing is in significant difficulty already. Its vital signs are showing indications of wear and tear, at least. Of course, cultures are made up of individuals. And the reason that you could ever have a culture in crisis is because a culture is made up of individuals who themselves are in crisis. And one of the great crises of individuals in our postmodern 21st century is their own identity crisis. So that to be able to answer the question, who are you, which is where John finished and where we go tomorrow, I guess, is a huge question. Who are you? If the individual is not to say, which would be, if you like, a Christian response. If the individual is not to say, it wouldn't necessarily need to be a Christian response. It would be a religious response. A similar response would be made in Islam. If the person is not to say, I am a moral being made in the image of God, a God to whom I am accountable. If they're not to say that, then what are they to say? Well, they'll say things like this. I am my genes. That's with a G. I am my sexual orientation. I am my past. I am my self-image. I am my personality. I am the sum total of my experiences. I am what I have. I am what I eat. I am what I do. I am who I know. The issue of identity, the issue of selfness, the issue of who and what a person is, that person who comes to you and goes underneath your physician's care, that person is asking that question. And if the physician is honest, he or she is also asking the question. And one might argue that the answer to that question on the part of the physician is the great determining factor in the care that the physician is able to offer. Far more, ultimately, than their technical abilities or even their intellectual capacities. Because the issue of who and what they are and what makes them the person they are determines the way in which they exercise the care they exercise. Now, that kind of bravado, I am what I own or I am who I know or whatever else, echoes with its own emptiness. It's just empty, isn't it? You may know, some of you, the name Walter Lippmann and his book, A Preface to Morals. I'm going to give you an extensive quote. I try and stay awake for all of it. He describes postmodern man, qua man, we can include women in this, it's not a sexist statement. He describes postmodern man experiencing, quotes, moments of blank misgiving, in which he finds that the civilization of which he is a part leaves a dusty taste in his mouth. He may be very busy with many things, but he discovers one day that he is no longer sure that they are worth doing. He has been much preoccupied, but he is no longer sure he knows why. He has become involved in an elaborate routine of pleasures, and they do not seem to amuse him very much. He finds it hard to believe that doing any one thing is better than any other thing, or in fact is better than doing nothing at all. It occurs to him that it is a great deal of trouble to live, and that even in the best of lives, the thrills are few and far between. He begins more or less to seek satisfaction because he is no longer satisfied. And all the while he realizes that the pursuit of happiness was always a most unhappy quest. You say, well, this is terrible. 9:05 on a Friday night. Is it? And now we're embracing a culture of bewilderment and despair and nihilism. And I still have to drive home. But stay with me for just a moment. It's not possible for any one of us to read that quote without being tweaked into it somewhere along the line. And, if I may say so kindly to you, when the physician gets the dusty taste in his or her mouth, when the physician gets the dusty taste in their mouth, having brought all of their skills and modern technology to bear upon the healing process so as to be able in the rounds to say, "You may go home today, Mrs. Brown." That physician who parked her car only an hour previously and tried with another bottle of Evian to assuage the dusty taste within her mouth, that physician will have to refrain from remarking to Mrs. Brown before she leaves that as happy as both she and the physician are that her condition has been alleviated and she is able to go home, we do not want to mention to her the empty, useless world to which Mrs. Brown now returns. And when that philosophical notion grips the mind of a person, and particularly somebody in the healthcare industry, it is manifold stupidity to believe that because this person possesses the necessary medical faculties to engage the issues of the day, to the extent that their mouths are dusty with that taste, it is germane to the issues of physician-assisted suicide. It is germane to the issue of living wills. I'm not so concerned as a man in the street to know that you have the intellectual faculty to make decisions as my physician. I am concerned as the man in the street to know what your worldview is that allows you then to bring your intellect and your capacities as a physician to bear upon me as an individual. Because it is that larger question, the question of ethics, the question of morality, the question of moral philosophy, the question about the oughtness, the question about human identity, which of course makes a level playing field for both patient and doctor. Because we're all on the same road. And either this life is rich with significance as a result of the origins from which we've come and the destiny towards which we proceed, or perhaps this life is rich with nothing. And Sartre was right. And Hemingway encapsulates it. Life is just a dirty trick. A short journey from nothingness to nothingness. I think you would agree, wouldn't you? That the physician who embraces that kind of philosophy is going to execute decision-making on a whole different basis from someone who believes that they were made in the image of a creator God and to whom they are accountable and upon whose grace and providence they rely. Now, we could beat this to death, but we won't. Our patient, remember, he's still up on the table, Western culture, is confronted then by the ultimate paradox. Because here we are. I was brought up in Scotland, brought up in the second half of the 20th century, born in 52, and I grew up at the tail end of the establishment of everything that was put in place in terms of social welfare, in terms of the development of education, in terms of the healthcare system and everything else that came about as a result of the impact of both the First and Second World Wars. And the arguments that were made then by sociologists were the condition of humanity is directly related to our inability to provide adequate education, adequate health care, adequate resources, and so on. We need to provide the housing and everything else. Now, and the idea was that the sense of oughtness would be directly, you know, affected by all of that. Well, of course we did. And you know the circumstances in Britain as well as I do. And the same is true here. We are better paid, better fed, better housed, better educated, healthier than ever before, with more human rights, faster communication, more convenient transportation than we have ever known. True. Alongside all this largesse, however, are the signs of life in pain and travail. Since 1960 in the United States, the divorce rate has doubled, teen suicide has tripled, violent crime has quadrupled, the number in prison has quintupled, illegitimate children sextupled, and the number of those cohabitating has increased sevenfold. I quote David Myers in his book, The American Paradox. Spiritual Hunger in an Age of Plenty, Yale University Press. So just when the advances of modern science were holding out hope for the elimination of more disease and the prospect of a more bearable existence, at the very same time the human spirit was sagging beneath the burden of bewilderment. We could illustrate it multivariously, time goes. In the world of the arts, the time was ripe, wasn't it, for plays about nothing. So we have the two tramps on the stage, 1953 in Paris, and they're waiting for the guy who never comes. The opening line of the play, if you remember it, is nothing to be done. Nothing to be done. And of course, Beckett's play has no plot, no movement, nothing happens, no one goes anywhere, no conclusions are reached, and nothing is resolved. And Godot says, through the words of a wee boy who shows up, that he's definitely coming the following day. I say, well, that was 1953, these are the 90s. Yes, these are the 90s. And I would say that Beckett spawned Seinfeld. No? I mean, let's face it. Thomas Hibbs says that Seinfeld was a show about the comical consequences of a life in a world void of ultimate significance or a fundamental meaning. The show was, by its own account, a show about nothing. And don't you remember people saying, wasn't that an amazing show last night? Did you see the one last night? They finally reached the apex. What was it about? Nothing. What? Yes, it was a show about nothing. We have finally cracked it. Now we can have a show about absolutely nothing. Now in that cultural milieu, the picture of any kind of spiritual life, being like the journey of a pilgrim from an origin to a destination, has been replaced not with the picture of a pilgrim now, but the picture of a tourist. Pilgrims go places. Pilgrims came here. Pilgrims went west. Pilgrims had an agenda. Pilgrims had an identity. Pilgrims had an objective. Tourists just flit about. Change currency. Show up. Walk around. Poke their nose in. Avoid the bad places. Go to the good places. They absorb the moment. And then they chase on for the next set of experiences. Mark Green wrote a little poem called Tourists. It doesn't scan, but it's still quite good. Tourists, that's what we're becoming. Tourists. We move through life, flitting from idea to idea, from novelty to novelty, from new person to new person, never settling, always moving. Selecting the best sites, the highlights, the choice cuts. Avoiding the mess on the edge of town, the slums, all the uncomfortable things. The struggle of really knowing people. Never settling, always moving. Lest we hear the hollow clang of our own emptiness. Tourists, that's what we're becoming. Inquisitive, curious, picking up the tidbits of other people's depth. Tourists, flicking through our snapshots, the paper-thin trophies of our click-and-run existence, filing them away, loading the next roll of film, never settling, always moving. Tourists, that's what we're becoming. So when they call the name of the next patient, the chances are you're not calling in a pilgrim who has got an explanation for her origins and who has a date with destiny, if you like. Chances are you'll be calling in just a tourist. Alistair MacIntyre, in his book After Virtue, closes by suggesting that at this point in history, we face a situation much like that of the Christians at the fall of the Western Empire. Remember the barbarians. And he says the barbarism that we face expresses itself in a loss of the conception that human life has a telos, that human life has a final goal. Now, if you think about this again in relationship to healthcare, I mean, in the Terry Schiavo case, there's a huge difference in the approach to that. Whatever our view is of that, it's not my business to enter into it. I already said I wouldn't. But there is clearly a huge difference between perceiving of death as the end of all existence for all time and without eternity, and conceiving of death as not a cul-de-sac but a gateway to an ultimate destination that is eternal in its significance. Now let me wrap this up, because the question was, how are we getting the moral mandate to deal with the bioethics revolution? I want to suggest to you that there is no possibility of a meaningful moral mandate without someone to issue it. That there is no morality that is an all-embracing morality because in our postmodern culture, there is nothing that is normative. There's no common consensus. And in the seasickness of a world cut from the moorings of a creator, everything, as Dostoevsky said, is permissible. If God is dead, everything is permissible. We don't have to sit around and have these discussions about the ethical implications of cloning or what will happen to embryos. If God is dead, it is largely an irrelevant debate. Of course, intrinsically, existentially, people still refuse to embrace that. But they don't know what to do. And they don't know where to go. And some of those people are the healthcare people. Well, you say, do you have anything to say in a positive way to conclude? Yes, I do. Yes, I must finish on a positive note and make a run for my car. But I do have something. I do have something to say. I mean, I can only say what you probably expect me to say. I mean, when a religious professional gets up, you expect either that they will take an offering or that they will or they will say a prayer or something. But let me give it to you without expanding on it. The only way forward is to, first of all, accept the diagnosis of the human condition that the Bible provides. I understand that begs the question of the nature of the Bible, but for now, if you stay with me just for that, this is what it says. What may be known about God is plain to men and women, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power, His divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Then it says this. But although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. And what the Bible has to say is that the sense of bewilderment, the sense of alienation to which people would speak, that all of our alienation, psychological, social, relational, emotional, personal alienations are, says Scripture at least, tied to the fact of the great alienation. That man, qua man, is alienated by his own designs and desires from the very God who created him. That he is adrift from his moorings. Now, this isn't a new concept. That's why I read from Ecclesiastes 12. It's not as if somebody woke up and says, you know, this is a unique thought, isn't it? You know, the sort of the nihilism of the late 20th century and early 21st century is quite remarkable. No, it's not. Solomon started it right there in Ecclesiastes 1, didn't he? Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is utterly meaningless. So that's not a great way to start the day. No, but what he does is he views the framework of life, leaving out of the picture for the moment the notion of a link with a personal creator God. And he goes down the corridors of life and he says, if we view everything from under the sun, if we view it leaving out for the moment this part of the equation, then he essentially says with Hamlet, you know, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this life. Or with Macbeth, you know, it's a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, and it signifies absolutely nothing. And then he goes down all of those corridors, and he shows the emptiness and the futility of it, and then he brings it all around in chapter 12, and he says, but listen, this is what you need to do. Number one, he says, you need to remember your Creator. The word, therefore, remember, doesn't just simply mean to remember in the way you would remember an irregular Greek verb or an irregular French verb. But it means to ponder, it means to think upon, it means to cogitate upon, it means to get into, you know. Remember your Creator. In other words, he says, at issue here is the whole matter of origins. And then he says, and prepare for your final exam. Because everything is moving, he says, towards an appointment with the God who made you. You see how this addresses McIntyre's issue of the telos, of the final goal. These are the issues of life and death. And men and women today have to, from one perspective, decide, do they want to live in a world where nothing means anything? Do they want to live in a world where nothing is right and nothing is wrong, where nothing tastes? And if that is the dreadful conclusion to which they come, ethically and morally, it will have an impact on all of the issues that are before us in all of tomorrow. It is impossible to deal with these issues apart from some conviction about this larger picture. And you take, for example, and with this I'll shut up, but they take this in its saddest and ugliest form. March 23rd this year, Jeff Wise, Minnesota, the last large school killing this year so far. 6 foot tall, 250 pounds, wearing eye makeup and a black trench coat that all went all the way down to the floor. Living his life in cyberspace. Alienated from friends, directly tuned in to a strange world. And eventually he takes out the janitor, the school teacher, 5 friends, his grandparents, and himself. On his website, and I don't even know if I have it here, but on his website, his favorite quote was, "The law of existence requires uninterrupted killing so that the better may live." The law of existence requires uninterrupted killing so that the better may live. Quote from whom? Adolf Hitler. Now, surely we are naive to think that a young man like that can be brought up to believe that he exists as a result of time plus matter plus chance. That his life is largely an irrelevancy, and that when you die, it is oblivion and there is nothing more. Admittedly, it's a dramatic response to the information. But I don't think he's very unlike many, many people. It's just that on the east side of Cleveland, with a modicum of family structure and the various bits and pieces that hold our fragile lives together, many of us are able to pretend that we don't have that dry, dusty taste in our mouths. And anyway, even if we do, we can always go to the mall and buy things. I agree with what John said. Bioethics is at the forefront of a 21st century apologetic for the Christian, and is at the forefront, is on the cutting edge of the future of Western civilization as we know it. We do not have the benefits, yes, benefits, of the theocracy of an Islamic state, albeit with all the downsides. We do not have the clarity of that. We are the greatest multicultural hodgepodge of belief systems that probably the Western world has ever seen to this point in history. And in the midst of all of that, I don't think the answer is in some great media blitz. I think the answer is in you, when you form your convictions, in your lab, in your home, in the OR room, when you look a patient in the eye, when you draw blood, when you sit with the bad news, when you rejoice in the good news, bringing to bear upon that moment the kind of convictions that make sense of a life, not just in the immediacy of the issue that they face, but in the big picture to which they return. When the wheelchair takes them down to the exit, and when the caregiver picks them up in the car, and when they drive away into the routine, when they drive away into the rest of their lives, they drive into what? And when you go home, where do you go?
You've been listening to Alistair Begg. You're welcome to pass this message along to others, but please do not charge for this message or alter it without written permission from Alistair Begg or Truth for Life. This message has been provided to you free of charge by the generous supporters of Truth for Life. For additional information about how you can support Truth for Life, please visit us online at truthforlife.org. There, you will also find additional free message downloads from Alistair Begg and other resources to help you grow in your Christian faith. Again, the website is truthforlife.org. Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.